This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Lodi, California. Come along and join me as I visit with Bradley Ogden, who's a seminal chef in the history of cuisine on the West Coast. Hey, Bradley.
Good morning, Tom.
This is the first time I've had the pleasure to meet you in person, but I've followed in your dust trail around California world for decades. You're One Market Street. I was there right on the heels of your opening there. And so many chefs I've interviewed around the state of California that talk so fondly and reverentially about you and how you played and play a seminal role in tutoring and training and kind of mother hen for some of these young up-and-coming chefs.
I remember years ago when I was at the Julia Child's home kitchen down in Santa Barbara. 1983, he was a young chef, nervous as all heck. I'm from Michigan, you know, didn't have a whole lot of training, but, you know, stepped into the kitchen and taken to a piano with no lessons, more or less. So off to Santa Barbara when I was a chef at the American Restaurant to do dinner and a show with Julia Child. I still remember the dish, a Sugar Bush Maple Mountain Mousse. That's a mouthful, isn't it? It was with a vanilla custard sauce. But I remember Julia stepping into the kitchen. She was out foraging for mushrooms. It was a March morning, raining cats and dogs. And here's Julia, you know, 6 foot nine or 7 feet tall, coming in this yellow rain suit and big rain. Bradley, look what I got. I have morels and, you know, but it was just the enthusiasm and the energy and that she had. And it was just like one of those memorable instances in my life.
One of your earlier moment.
Yeah, 1983, when I was still in the middle of the country at the American Restaurant in Kansas City. You know, my mentors were Joe Baum and Barbara Kofka and James Beard, so some luminaries in our profession. So next thing I know, which I didn't want to because I thought California was going to drop into the ocean with the next earthquake. You know, I moved from Kansas City to San Francisco to open up Campton Place Hotel. But had an opportunity to work with many chefs that I were stepped into my kitchen, like Charlie Trotters, Michael Moonen, just many luminaries now in our profession and have many restaurants and have succeeded in this hospitality business.
When you first interacted with some of these guys, is when they were starting out, right?
I didn't know. I mean, I was just making my own waves, more or less, and I'm just trying to cook food that I like to eat, you know, and gathering farms and growers nearby in San Francisco. And
let's rewind back to Michigan. Were you always in the kitchen? Was that something in elementary school you're into? You know, when did it, what happened?
So here's the deal. So I grew up in a big Catholic family with seven of us, twin brother. There was four of us under the age of four.
Medium size.
Mediums. You know, typical Midwestern Catholic family, right? And this is, I graduated high school in 71 or 72. My dad owned a big rock and roll joint called Tantas. Had all the big bands up in Traverse City, Bob Seger, wow, the Eagles, and all the bands used to come up. It was the biggest rock and roll joint in Michigan at the time. He had it for 25 years or so. I mean, I grew up like many kids. We would go squeegee the floors and bartend and security guard and go play golf across the street, not knowing really what profession I was going to hop into. But, you know, when I was 18, I went into drafting for about 6 months, and my dad saw an article in the Detroit Pre-Press. He always wanted a family business, like a restaurant. He loved food. We didn't have much, but I spent a lot of summers on my grandmother's farm in Windsor, Ontario, when I was a kid, picking beefsteak tomatoes, fresh corn, and watching her butcher the chicken, hanging it, and fresh pies. And so I really learned how to have a palate way back when. No idea to me. So I saw an article in Detroit Free Press on the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. We're talking 72. So he figured if I learned how to cook it, I could always get a job. So I didn't really step into a kitchen until I was 18. At the local Holiday Inn, flipping eggs with, I called her my Aunt B, because she was, you know, just took me around her, you know, apron. And, you know, I dishwasher, bellhop, and, you know, did sort of all that for about 6 months, and then started flipping eggs with Aunt B, then off to culinary school. So Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, not the CIA, which people thought I actually was in. So we're talking about the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York, when it first went from Boston area to Hyde Park.
But how did you qualify? I mean, that's a miracle, isn't it, that you got in?
Well, at that time, yeah, because it was like getting into Fort Knox, yeah. basically. And so you had to have references and this and that. And so somehow I got in. So I did 1 year in 73, 74 when it first opened up. I just loved it. I mean, it was just like my brother ended up dropping out and joined the Navy and cooked in the Navy. But I loved it. Then I got 4 more years of experience in between, got married, had a couple kids, and...
And this was on the East Coast, or did you come back to Midwest?
No, I came back to the Midwest, uh-huh. to Michigan, to Traverse City, and worked with Bob Taylor, I still remember that, at the local Holiday Inn, and we opened another Holiday Inn, so it was like, I got quite a bit of experience within those 4 years. It meant a lot more to me, because I had 3 jobs at the Culinary Institute of America when I was there.
One more thing on Traverse City, because I've been there a couple times recently, and... That place blows my mind from a food scene. Isn't it incredible?
Now, yeah. You know, I've had glimpses of thought that I might open a restaurant, but then I thought, well, do I really want to deal with those winters again? But it is a growing, bustling community. Would I have liked to just keep the 20,000 people when I was living there? Yeah, mm-hmm. but wouldn't we all? But it's probably got 200,000 now. And then, of course, in summertime, it's probably 1 million with the vacationers. But... I mean, the wine and the food, and now they're doing hops, which is really bad to me because they're taking out some of the cherry trees. It is still the cherry capital of the world. I remember picking those darn things when I was 16, 17, making a few dollars. But it's a great restaurant and culinary scene, and they have a hospitality there at the local college program. And so it's very exciting to go to. I mean, I usually try to make sure I go in October, first part of October, where I know the weather's going to be awesome.
If you said, let's go to Michigan, where do you want to go? That probably literally would be my first choice to go hang out in Traverse City.
I remember all the fish boils, and I mean, there's nothing like, I mean, all I eat there is fried perch and walleye pike when I go, and so it's like, my family's still there, my mom's still doing good, so I need to get back soon. Yeah. But a lot of people don't know the community, how gorgeous it still is up in that area. The pristine lakes and streams, and you can still catch a lot of good walleye pike and fresh trout.
How did you get to the West Coast?
Well, from Michigan to Culinary Institute of America. Then I took my first real chef job, in which I opened 3 or 4 restaurants prior to this. I graduated in 77 with honors, Richard T. Keating Award, and most likely to succeed. I mean, I'm just not bragging, I'm telling you, right. Out of 500 kids. And I was so nervous to go up and speak. So then I off to Kansas City from there and became the chef of the American restaurant in Kansas City. And my mentors were Joe Baum, Barbara Kafka, James Beard. Not a bad group of...
And that's where you first met James Beard.
Yes.
And you established a friendship with him, didn't you?
Ever since the early 80s. And so, matter of fact, I used to cook for him at Campton Place when he used to come and visit in San Francisco. He would order whole roasted chickens and special stuff. But anyway, so then... So I got an offer to come out to open up Campton Place Hotel in the early 80s, and when American food was just getting known for our talent that we had in our community with our chefs. And
there were some seminal key players. I always think of Alice Waters in Berkeley, and she really did a magnificent job of making it imprinted in people's minds around America.
There was a tight group of chefs that were... You know, there was Jimmy Schmidt, you know, from Detroit. There was Jeremiah Towers. There was Larry Forgione, Jonathan Waxman, just a few Cajun contingent, Paul Perdome. You know, so there was a group of...
But isn't it interesting that collectively there was this specific thematic momentum that was happening? And it must have been a metaphor for the time and place, too.
You know, everybody wanted... It was a time when... Our heritage was really kicking with American food, American flag. I would say in the 80s, 1980 to 1990, it was all American food and American chefs. And, you know, it was all farm to table. That's what the word was. I mean, to me, I've always cooked that way. I mean, the best way to cook is what you gather from the ground and, you know, bring it to the table in a timely fashion and trying to retain the nutrients and vitamins and the simplicity of the food. But in saying that, in 1983, there was a big article in Food & Wine magazine. All the American chefs came together. Jimmy Schmidt and I represented, and I think this was the start of our American food. We had a big dinner in 1983, 300, 400 people. Everyone was there. It was, you know, from Julia Child, you name it, from the hospitality culinary scene was there. It was a gathering of all these chefs, and I represented the Midwest with Jimmy Schmidt. We did a, still remember the lamb rack dish that we butterflied open, and he brought these wild vegetables from Michigan, and anyway, stuffed it with a sort of a kale and bitter green and hazelnut. Rolled it back up into...
So you're the guy that started kale then, huh?
Well, that could have been. I'm not sure about all that one. But anyway, so I think the gathering of that really spearheaded American food at that time. And then Food & Wine did a big article on the top chefs in America and all these young, bustling chefs that used to have a lot of hair on their head. But I think that was the start of it all. And then...
How did it evolve going into the 90s? You had Keller and the French Laundry and a lot of shifting.
Well, then it became a little more the foreign soils, I would say, with the French, with the Asian, with the Hawaiian flair to it. And I think there was this melting pot of all these cultures that represented the heritage of American food, what it is today. And I think that my whole style has always been, you know, my Midwest with the organic grits and whatever it is, fish boils and, you know, from New England. But it's always been a repertoire. But you know, and I know, the more you travel, the more education you're going to have. I mean, now I know, you know, what a good French bread is out of olive wood burning oven in Paris. Now I know what Thai food is because I've been to Thailand. And, you know, I've been to Hong Kong. I've been to Japan. So it's like you pick up a little more repertoire for your own.
It's a never-ending process for you. You're still learning.
Always. You never know enough. And once you stop, you might as well pack it in if once you stop learning, because it's like it's still exciting to me when I go to a farmer's market, you know, and I pick up a melon, and you know, and I know it's just been plucked from the field, and it's heavy, and it's ripe, and you smell that vibrancy. And then you're thinking culinary-wise, okay, what am I going to do with it? You know, pressed melon salad or whatever it may be. But as long as you still have that excitement and you can teach and you can be taught, extremely important in our profession.
Let's go forward. You were Campton Place, and then what?
And then I opened up Campton Place in 1983, was there 6 years. Toward the end of it, I was creating my own restaurant. I didn't know it was going to turn into 18 restaurants later. But opened that with my partner, Michael Deller, and of course, Jody and Leslie and our wives. And then, so we opened that up. That was Lark Creek Inn at the time. So I went from Campton Place to open up Lark Creek Inn in 1989.
Where was that located?
Oh, that was in, Lark Creek Inn was in Marin County in the Bay Area. In
Larkspur. Yeah.
Larkspur, California. People say, well, why are you not doing a restaurant in the city? And why do you want to go out there? You're not going to be successful. I mean, you know, it's like...
Why did you?
Well, it was ideal for my next... Because I wanted to do something a little more country with the food. And it was setting up... You know, it was this old house, and it was along the creek there. We outdoor dining. I put in a big wood-burning oven. So it was ideal for my American fare that I wanted to do. A little more country than I had at Campton Place. Still ethically sound. What I mean by that is that I had probably 100 farmers that I dealt with. And I had people dropping off fresh sturgeon that they just plucked from the ocean in my back door, or fresh corn that was just picked from up by Sonoma, and Laura Chanel goats that I used to buy and cheap.
So that literal fresh local, knowing the source, knowing the farmer, that's always been a part of your lexicon.
You know, it's funny.
Central.
It's funny. Yeah, it's always been a part of my repertoire. I mean, to me, that's the only way to cook. You know, from actual farm to table. And I helped Lynn Bagley put the Marin Farmers Market together way back in 1983. So it was an ebb and flow of my cuisine, and always has been. And I think that was, technically speaking, I think the lessons I learned from Joe Baum, you know, attention to detail, you know, commitment to excellence. He had me in tears more than once at the American restaurant. But because he wanted to make sure that I maintain that ethical value on food and you know, the freshness of the quality of it. So in saying that, I mean, even Michael David, Phelps Farm, I used to buy, and I had no idea that now he's a winemaker.
And right nearby.
Right here in Lodi. Uh-huh. That's why I say that. I never really stepped into Lodi till about 2 years ago. But I was buying from, this is like the egg community of California, and so I was buying from a lot of the farmers in the Bay Area that were at the local farmers markets in Marin and San Francisco. But things have a way of going around.
At what point did you get and understand that flavor balancing between wine and food? How early did that epiphanous moment happen?
Remember where I grew up? They didn't have me in Michigan, okay?
I know, yeah.
It wasn't like a wine community.
I know, so at some...
I do think in the early 80s, where I believe Lodi is right now, Napa came into fruition. I mean, you know, it was like it was young, it was growing, and, you know, of course you had Mondavis and the family and cake breads and all these. It's not what it was today. So, and I really think that in saying that, wine and food... there's two key ingredients to that. Either you have great grapes and bring them to the table and press them in, so you retain the nutrients and vitamins and the character of the grape. Same with food. They have a balance of, you know, it's either good or not. So, yes, now you have to do, once you have that, you can put your creative niche to it. You know, mine always has been light and fresh and California influence. Not at the beginning, mine was a little more richer because I came from a European background with the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, my teachings. But then it became lighter and lighter as I, you know, and balance more things and use less flour and more acidities and fresh ingredients, chilies, peppers, pressed juices and, you know, things that would enhance, not take away from the character of the beginning of the dish, but to enhance every bite and you know, where it's not just flat, but it's, there's a spark of acid in it. There's a spark of little ginger that's going to add a little more pepper to it. So now you're building the plate. And I've always sort of had that technique, build the plate with character, but keep it simple.
I expected if I ever had the pleasure of meeting you in person, it would be in Marin County or it would be in San Francisco. And here I waltz into Lodi, California, and there you are. You could have set up a restaurant, you could have reinvented yourself today anywhere in the world, but you chose Lodi. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, I did. It was a choice. I was rebuilding my career.
You still have a management company, right?
I still do. I'm still part of One Market Restaurant in San Francisco. But then I had an opportunity, I had a decision to make, either come as a culinary director here at Wine and Roses or open another restaurant in the Bay Area. I thought hard and long about it.
Was it tempting because you already had the infrastructure in place? Made it easier?
You know, yes. The key was that the executive chef that was here actually worked for me for 8 years. Opened up Lark Creek Inn with me and mentored him and, you know, that sort of thing. And he was on board here. Now he's no longer here. And so that was the basic reason why I was coming on board with the two of us as a team.
But there's more to it than that. There's location, destination, where you're living. What got you? Why Lodi was a hook for you?
First of all, I always wanted to do my own boutique hotel. And this was close enough without putting any money into it. So we have a 67 room, sprawling 2-acre ranch, I call it, here at Wine and Roses. And I felt coming to Lodi would be a better way of life. I could spend maybe a little more time with my grandkids. You know, now I have 4 of them under the age of 4. So it's like, you know, I could do a little more. I could step away with it, not knowing that it's mine, even though I do take that on, that ownership, because I've owned restaurants for 30 years. So I do take that on. But I felt there was going to be lots of opportunity to grow and develop things here on campus and through the community, as well as a different lifestyle.
As I look at you and watch you and observe you in context where we are, in my mind I'm going, this dude is immersed in the middle of the terroir of all the growers and ag. The breadbasket of the world. It's amazing. And you are inches away from the farmers.
You know, that's extremely a fact because it's like, yes, not only do you have now, which is, and that's why I said it's like Lodi, you know, sort of like the 80s where Napa was in the Bay Area. But I think that now you had a small group of wineries back then. Now you have 125 to 135 wineries here in Lodi. It's a combination of 2 miles away, you know, I'm getting heirloom tomatoes and fresh corn and strawberries and heirloom beans and melons and, you know, I'm in this toy factory, as I call it. But in both areas, in the ag community as well as the wine community, you see this tremendous amount of growth. And yet, the ag wants to keep this small, little, tight community, which we all do. But inevitably, it will continue to grow and develop. You're getting Sonoma and Napa buying grapes from this area. And they have been doing that for years. And that's one part of it. But then you got the small town attitude, you know, which is awesome. It's like you got people going out kayaking and, you know, and they're enjoying a lifestyle.
And even just walking uptown, downtown. I mean, talk about Americana and that small town community feel. That must be an allure for you.
Again, you have a very small template of restaurants, but and then you have this little brick streets and, you know, in a four-block radius. And you know, there's, what, 80,000 people here? And you see it, the potential in the restaurant development as well as in hospitality. Yet we don't want to brag about it too much because we don't want it to build up. So
it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
It is.
Come see paradise so we can destroy it.
Exactly. No, but, you know, you don't have to deal with, I mean, the traffic, let's face it, traffic, L.A. and San Francisco, at times, most of the time, the traffic's just standing. You can't get around, and, you know, and so, you know, it was definitely a choice of lifestyle for Bradley. You know, I've done it, I've been there, and not that I don't want to do it again, mind you. I just opened another restaurant on campus here, I call it On Campus, at Wine and Roses. We opened up a little coffee cafe, little restaurant that's part of it, and so everything's artisan, organic, and, you know, we're being as much creative as we want to be. Right now, we got 12 to 14 products that we're doing for everything. I'm starting up a beef jerky program, and we do fresh juices every day, organic almond milk or organic syrups. So
let's keep on the organic track for a moment. How central is that to your philosophy?
Organic is one of those words that's sort of deceptive. Sustainability it's always been a part of.
But sustainability is probably the most amorphous word in the entire industry.
And then you throw them both together, organic and sustainability. Yeah. So, you know, all I want is great food, right, be able to cook, you know, good food with. We work very well with our local growers and farmers, hand in hand. I do special wine dinners, you know, that were a partnership with our wineries here at Townhouse, our boutique restaurant, as well as now we're, you know, I have two Bay Area chefs that I brought on, very much that sort of organic sustainability that we're culturing into the banquet food as well as to our parts of it. I've always been a nut about nutrition and the value of that, because I know that if we retain a few more nutrients and vitamins, it's what? Flavor.
I'm a dreamer just like you. And in my mind, I'm visualizing as we're talking, Bradley Ogden starting a cool chef event that would take place here in Lodi, where you would draw on all your chef friends from around the country, around the world. Wouldn't that be awesome?
You know, we've been talking about, because I think over the years I've known that if the best way to market a business is what you do in-house. And we've been talking about we've been doing it for years here in Wine and Roses, but what can we do to take ownership in something like a chef's dinner or something that's going to, first of all, be sustainable, meaning that pays for itself, because, you know, it's business after all, plus being able to get back to the community from a local to a national event. And so it's funny you say that, because we've been tossing around ideas.
I think it's an absolute natural. I mean, how cool would it be? Home run. You draw people from all over the state of California to come here.
That would be fun. Of course, we have a place for them to stay. Maybe set up some tours. And there are some golf courses around, and I know that many of them play. Anyway, that would be fun.
Talk just for a moment about your philosophy of presentation of food.
Mine is not necessarily showmanship on the plate, but the essence of what's on the plate. Meaning that if there's a pot roast, the braise has to be correct. It has to be seared. If you want a sous vide, that's fine, but it's got to be low and slow. And then have this wonderful, with no flour, just whatever you're going to do with it. I mean, if you're going to do a summer pot roast, then the roasted beets and heirloom carrots need to be roasted perfectly. The sauces, it could be just a red wine essence with summer onions that are stewed down and maybe a few apples in it, and you make this wonderful glaze for the short rib. And it melts in your mouth, and maybe there's some crushed heirlooms, little potatoes under the short rib, and every component needs to be correct, and there needs to be a reason for things being there. Not just throwing on some microgreens for a garnish. That'd mean nothing to me. You know, so it's like anybody can do that. You know, some good hots, some good salads, and, you know, things that sound good. Yes, you can be creative at times.
playful.
And playful. Maybe take, like we did, a pickled beef tongue, little taco the other day. You know, but I used some gypsy peppers. I made a couple little salsas with it and stuff that was just picked from the farm locally. So it's all about the character and using, you know, the local ingredients that are only a mile or 2 miles away from us and just picked.
Have you bumped into any surprises, pleasant agricultural surprises, since you've been in Lodi?
I'm thinking about that one. I can say two things. Because business has gotten so tough.
How so?
Because you have a lot of those California laws, good and bad, I mean, you know, for the employee. And so, you know, you got to make sure you have the 10-minute breaks, you got to have a 30-minute lunch, you got to, you know, it's like things that I wasn't used to, you know, because I was always, last few years, and you know, I was delegating stuff, take care of it, to the chef or the manager. And so,
well, you're back of the house, and there's that whole other world front of the house, the servers and tipping issues and whatnot, and that's been a game changer,
I would love to get, you know, we haven't been able to do it here. There's only a few restaurants in California that have done it, and Alice being one, where we, you know, where we pool the tips, you know, so the you know, we're really trying to get where the back of the house gets a fair wage, just like the front of the house. It's a hard thing to balance because they're so used to what they've been doing. But I see it from both things. I don't see it just from front. You know, I'm in charge of both areas, more or less. And I see it from an ownership perspective.
But you also look at the employee.
As our employee, yeah. You know, that I work hand-in-hand with every day, our cooks. And would I like to have them all making a decent wage so they can take care of their family and pay their bills? And of course. It's, you know, and here it's a little bit cheaper cost of living in Lodi. I mean, you know, it'll change eventually because you're seeing a lot of people that can't afford the cost of working in the city. So they're going to have to move out of the city. And so it's a challenge with all of our state laws and taxes on taxes. And it shrinks the profitability. It used to be around 15% maybe, profitability. Now it's probably lucky 8-9%. And so
those are pretty tight margins.
Very, very tight. You know, so you're sort of thinking twice, you know, why in the heck am I going into the hospitality business? But it's a love, you know. And,
well, it's who you are.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, you try to make, you know, somehow you have to change the law to fit the operations too. And I mean then you got to think of better ways to be able to make profit so you can take care of your guests and so you can take care of your staff, you know, so everybody grows. Those are the big challenges in our profession. I mean, you see a lot of people dropping out of it.
I'm going to throw a curveball at you.
Yep.
Let's say you and I can go to the city, San Francisco, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Where would you take me to dinner?
Oh, boy.
I know. See, that's a brutal one.
Of course, I'd probably take you to One Market.
which I love. So, I mean, it's got everything going for it. Location, architecture, historic area. It's just, I've always loved that place, you aside.
You know, I was asked that, there was a young cook that I was talking to the other day, and here walking around with one of our managers over at Rosewood. And what I said to him, I said, there's three or four things that you really, if you're going to be in the business. One, you need a passion for it. Two, a commitment and love. Those two things, usually you'll be successful at it in any profession, not just the hospitality. But and then have, you need a one-year plan, a two-year goals. Keep on, you know, what if it's 5 years from now to open up your own place, well, do your homework. Do the financial end. You know, make sure there's enough capital. Most people go out of business because they're undercapitalized in the first year. Yeah. You know, and if you're going to open something, what you have to do is build it from the back to the front. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is make sure you have a good concept, you know, a good menu. Build the back of the house to support your concept first. Most people, because they're more front of the house, they build this luxury, beautiful boutique restaurant from the outside.
It looks great.
From the outside in. And then, oh my God, I can't afford that oven. Or I can't, no, I have this square. Oh, I want another table in the front. I'd rather have a line out the door and have fewer tables than not being able to succeed to do your concept in a professional and delicious manner.
Bradley Ogden, only because I've been hogging your time, you've got to get back to work, I'm going to let you go. But what a wonderful morning to be with you and have you share your journey.
And by the way, guys, it's like we have these big trees. I forget what the name of these trees. They're like a pine tree, but
Deodar.
Thank you. Yeah, deodar trees, and then you have the birds are, you know, parrots here that are singing in the background, and these flowers, and this is what we're sitting. And so
you do know you're spoiled.
I'm extremely spoiled. Every day, get this. This has been a challenge. Okay, I talk to Lola and Peaches every day, right? For the last year and a half, and say hello. They're finally now coming up to me after a year and a half.
These are the parrots, right?
Those are the parrots. So we're looking forward to seeing you here in Lodi. And so, Tom, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. And we can continue this verbiage on for a long time.
Well, I'm going to come hunt you down again. We'll do part two.
Oh, that'd be great. I'm going to go back and make some organic almond milk for our new cafe.
Cool. How does somebody find out more about you? Do you have a website or anything?
All you have to do is go online and Google Wine and Rosa Resort and Spa, and it'll bring up. And, you know, I'm there on the internet as well, someplace, somewhere.
Okay, Bradley Ogden, thanks again.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Lodi, California. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.